take like 5 minutes at the start to say a few words about some of the main implementations of quantum computers. The other board was drying, so I wrote it over here. So I hope it's not too hard to see. But you know, this is not something that you necessarily need to know in depth as far as the main content of this course is going. But I just wanted to give you kind of a very rough overview of what are considered the leading contenders for possible implementations of quantum computers. Arranged here sort of more or less according to the gate time, so how long it would take to do a unitary operation, you know, some elementary gate in one of these implementations. So, you know, with the slowest gates, we have nuclear magnetic resonance. So this is a system in which the qubits consist of nuclear spins. We can have, you know, different nuclear spin states, and they can represent our quantum information. And we can naturally do interactions between nuclear spins because they interact according to some dipolar coupling. There's a major problem with this approach, though, which is that it's often done, sometimes this is done in the liquid state, so the molecules are in some liquid, and then the system is actually at quite a high temperature, and the states that you can prepare are very mixed. And so it doesn't meet this, it's quite far from meeting the Civincenzo criterion of being able to initialize a pure state. And there's some scalability problems that go along with that. So although it's easy to do kind of proof of principle demonstrations using these kinds of systems, it's probably the least likely of the candidates on this list to eventually lead to a large-scale quantum computer. Now, you can also talk about doing similar kinds of interactions between systems in the solid state, and maybe there would be more potential, although perhaps there would be other problems that would come up. Okay, so next, with some slightly faster gates, the next implementation that's written here is this idea of trapped ion quantum computing, which if I had to pick one, I would say this is probably the furthest ahead in terms of what can be done, what kinds of quantum gates can be implemented, and how many qubits you can interact reliably. So here, the qubits consist of electronic states of ionized particles, and these ions are trapped in some kind of a magnetic trap, so you can hold them in particular locations. And you can manipulate the individual ions by shining laser pulses at them, and you can get them to interact with each other through their mutual phonon modes. So there are vibrational modes of these ions in the trap. They can they can move back and forth, and you can actually, you know, if you cool the system very well, you can actually treat this mode quantum mechanically and use it as a bus to exchange information between different ions. So this is I would say one of the most promising potential implementations of quantum computers. There's another proposal with similar properties in that also the quantum information would be stored using electronic states, but now using neutral atoms, which are trapped in optical lattices. So these are like standing wave patterns that are made by shining a few lasers across each other. So you can trap atoms in the sort of like egg carton kind of potential, and ideally initialize these lattices so you have maybe just one or no atoms in each of the little potential wells, and you can do interactions in a way where you bring atoms together. So you take atoms from adjacent spots in these optical lattices, you bring them together, and then the electrons are able to interact, and then you can separate them again. So this is another potentially promising implementation, although often it's hard to get very individual addressing of individual atoms. Yes.
You say bring the atoms together and then electron-electron interaction?
Yeah, that's right. So it's easy to get electric charges to interact, and that's what that's the way the interactions would occur. So in these systems are often considered for doing sort of analog quantum simulations. So it's possible that we could use these kinds of systems to simulate say condensed matter systems. Before we could actually build a reliable quantum computer that really implemented fault tolerance and all these sorts of things. And then another potentially promising implementation is this idea of superconducting qubits. And there are several different kinds of superconducting qubits that people try to build where the quantum information is stored either in the charge or in magnetic flux, so whether you have a current going clockwise or counterclockwise around some loop. Or in the superconducting phase. So these are all different ways you can store quantum information. The charge method is really probably the one that is least likely to be used, is least likely to give a good implementation because it's subject to a lot of decoherence. These are different ways to potentially store quantum information. And in all of these kinds of systems, you can implement interactions using what are called Joseph's injunctions, which you should think of as sort of like a nonlinear inductance. And so you can make some kind of a nonlinear oscillator where you can address the you can separately address the zero and the one levels, and you can use these to create interactions between the qubits. And one reason that this is a potentially promising implementation is that if you want to try to scale things up, the sort of technology that you would use to try to lay out some superconducting system is quite similar to what we would use to design regular computer chips, classical computer chips. I mean, now we need to deposit superconducting wires as opposed to just regular conducting wires on the surface of some kind of semiconductor. But it's basically some kind of a semiconductor structure that you want to build. And there's very advanced technology for fabricating these kinds of devices. And the last sort of system here, which would be the one that has the fastest gate operation times, these are what are called quantum dots, which are sort of like artificial atoms, which are made by having some kind of a two-dimensional electron gas, and you have little islands where you can have just zero or one electron, and you can, but they can be sort of quite large things where you have some large artificial atom, and so we can store information in the spin of the electron that might be on one of these islands, and we can do interactions between different qubits using the exchange interaction. So basically, the Fermi statistics of the electrons. So I realize I went through this very quickly. I just wanted to give you a flavor of what some of the implementations are that people are thinking about. Of course, there are many other implementations that you could potentially think about, and there's a course here that I think David Corey gives where he talks probably in more detail about different implementations of quantum information processing. But this is just some kind of a flavor of some things you might think about. So questions about any of these? Yes?
Where on this list would D-Wave's alleged implementation fall?
So that's a superconducting implementation. Yeah, so they're trying to make use of this idea that, what I was saying, that we have good technology for laying out big, complicated structures on silicon chips, and we could potentially, create many, many qubits in a system using technology that we already have available to us. Whereas, for example, if you want to trap many ions in one of these ion traps, the way it's conventionally done, which is to have kind of some quadrupolar configuration of electrodes, and you trap the ions in a line, you just can't put in that many ions before you lose your ability to trap them well. And so, if you want to really make ion traps scalable, you probably have to have some way of exchanging information between different traps, or lay out the traps somehow on a chip in some different configuration where you can actually move ions around, or make a more complicated architecture. So it's easier to make a system with more qubits using current technology with this kind of superconducting system, and that's maybe one of the reasons that, well, you'd have to ask them, but I think that's probably one of the reasons that D-Wave is interested in building superconducting systems. There was actually one other thing I wanted to say, though, which your question brings up, which is, often when someone asks me, something about how progress is coming experimentally with quantum computing, well, first I tell them that I'm the wrong person to ask. But, then I would say, so usually the first question they would ask is, like, how many qubits can you make, right? So they want some measure of how big a computer can you build, so they have some idea of how large a computation you could do. But I think that's really the wrong question to ask. I mean, how many qubits do you have is sort of like, you could have a lot of really lousy qubits, and what does that really mean, right? So I think really the right question to ask is how well can you control the qubits that you have? And this is really one of the problems for a lot of these implementations. I mean, I would say in ion traps, maybe you could argue that people have the most precise control over the kinds of interactions and gates that they can do. But that's really a problem for all of these implementations, is really to be able to have very precise control over the system. And as we'll see when we talk about fault tolerance, you really need to have quite good control of your system before you can, in principle, say that you have a scalable system where you could effectively ignore the noise. So there's quite a high bar that you need to meet before you could reach what's called the fault tolerance threshold. We'll talk about that more later on. Okay, good. Other questions? Okay, great. So that's it for implementations. And so, as I said, the main subject of today's lecture is going to be computational complexity. So this is a precursor to thinking about algorithms and specific algorithms that solve specific problems. But before we do that, I would like to talk a little bit about complexity in general. So how do we measure how difficult it is to solve some particular computational problem? How do we classify the difficulty of solving different kinds of computational problems? How do we relate different models of computation to one another? These are the sorts of questions that we want to address in computational complexity. Okay, so the first thing that I want to talk about is this notion of the Church-Turing thesis. So when we want to model computation, you know, we make up some kind of a mathematical model of a computer. And we've talked about such a model already, which is the circuit model, right? We have this notion of circuits, which we can use to implement computations. But you know, maybe this model of circuits we think of as some reasonable idealization of what we actually do when we build a computer. But we could come up with other models that might model other devices that we might potentially build that would be, you know, building such a device would be perfectly compatible with the laws of physics. And you know, so we might wonder when we're studying how hard it is to compute something or whether it's even possible to compute something, should we should we think about just the circuit model, or do we have to go and think about separately about the model of Turing machines, separately about the model of quantum or classical cellular automata, or other kinds of models that we might think about? And so what this Church-Turing thesis says is basically that it sort of asserts that you don't have to worry about this issue. So if you have any physically reasonable model of computation, it should be able to compute the same things. So there's sort of a standard currency for this kind of question, which is the Turing machine. So I'll state it in terms of the Turing machine. If you haven't seen the details of how a Turing machine works, don't worry about it so much. Just think of it as some kind of a reasonable model of how you might formalize the notion of whether you can compute some function. So the Church-Turing thesis would say the following: any physically reasonable model of computation can compute the same functions as a Turing machine. So first of all, notice that this is not a theorem. I mean, this is not a mathematical statement, because there's this phrase in here, physically reasonable, right? This is a claim about physics that the sorts of devices that we would be able to build in the real world in order to do computations would have the computational power of a Turing machine. Where here, when we think about what we can do, we're talking about the things that can be computed at all. So here we haven't yet talked about computational efficiency. We're just talking about what functions can be computed in principle. And so probably you know there are some problems that cannot be computed even in principle on a Turing machine. For example, the problem of figuring out whether a given Turing machine would halt on some input, right? So there's this notion of a halting problem, which is it's called an undecidable problem that can't even be solved, right? So there are some functions that cannot even be computed by a Turing machine. And what this thesis asserts is that the same, the class of functions that you can compute in principle, or the class of functions that you can't compute in principle, that class of functions does not change if you move between different physically reasonable architectures. So this is something which, seems to be borne out in practice. As I said, it's not a theorem, so we can't hope to prove it. But I think it's a good guiding principle, and it's really something that seems to be true. Yes?
So physically reasonable means something that can, in principle, be built.
Yeah, so it means something. Of course, we would like to talk here about mathematical models of things that could, in principle, be built. But the Turing machine is some kind of a model in which there's a long tape, and there's a finite state machine, and there's a head that can go back and forth and read the tape, or maybe the tape goes back and forth under the head. And you could imagine actually building such a device. You have a long tape, you have a head, you have a finite state machine, you actually build something that implements that. Now, of course, there may be idealizations in the model. Like in the model, the tape is infinitely long, and you could never build such a thing, and you have to kind of, take these idealizations with a grain of salt. So if you want to solve larger and larger problems, you might need a longer and longer tape. But these sorts of issues really only start to be a problem when we think about efficiency, which we're going to talk about in a bit. So there's one other point that maybe I should make here, which is that, one model that you might think of as a physically reasonable model of computation would be a circuit model, right? That was the main model we said we would use. And we had this notion of universality. We said the circuit model, even the classical circuit model was universal in the sense that it could compute any function. But that was actually any function. So like even the function that described the halting problem. So you might wonder kind of what's going on here. So there's a slightly subtle issue, which is that if we think about a reasonable model of computation, actually we shouldn't allow the model to do something completely different for inputs of different size, right? So when we study a problem, that problem consists of many different possible input instances of many different lengths. And we would like to have a notion of an algorithm where the algorithm behaves in some kind of reasonable way with respect to different input sizes. So more precisely, we would like to have some kind of finite description of the algorithm that we could then run on an input of any size, not just a completely different algorithm for every input size. So this is the notion of a uniform model of computation. So if we would demand that our circuits are uniformly generated, so there's some small description of the circuits that we could use to produce the circuit of an arbitrary size, then it would be what we would say, then I would say that it's physically reasonable, and it would have this property that it could compute the same functions as a Turing machine. So this is a somewhat subtle issue, but I wanted to just mention it in case you would think about that and how it relates to this notion. Yes.
So I'm trying to understand the status of this thesis. So is it something we hope to prove?
No, it's not something we hope to prove, because how would we ever prove this, right? I mean, we would first, if we had a given, set of laws that govern how the world works, if we had a theory of everything, right, then I guess we could in principle try to prove this, right? But we're never going to prove that, some physical theory actually describes the world, right? Because how do you do that? You just do experiments and you gather evidence that your theory is, that you sort of believe that your theory is right, but you never...
But even in the assumption that quantum mechanics is, for example, fundamental theory, then you can still not prove it?
Oh, then you can prove it. So then if you fix your, if you have some, mathematical definition of what operations can be done, then you can hope to prove it. And in fact, so, I mean, this brings us to the next point, which is, so this is something which seems to be true, and people, were very convinced that this was true when they were thinking just about classical computation. So, and if you formalize certain models, like you could say, let's think of Turing machines as a model of what we could do in the world. Let's think of, the lambda calculus, which is another model of the kinds of things we can do in the world. Let's think of classical cellular automata. You could actually prove that all of these things are equivalent to one another. But now quantum computing comes along, and now we have quantum models of computation, so say uniform families of quantum circuits, then we could ask, does it still seem to be true? And the answer is yes, it is still true, and the reason is that a quantum computation, so the evolution of some quantum circuit can always be simulated by a classical process. It's just that we may have to multiply exponentially large matrices. We could always just represent the whole state vector. I mean, now there's some issue of precision. With what precision do you represent the amplitudes? But it's possible to deal with these details. So you represent the whole state vector, and you just multiply it by the unitary matrices. You multiply the unitary matrices. You act on the state with the unitary matrices that describe the action of the quantum circuit. And then in the end of the day, you get a classical description of the final state of the quantum system, and you can get from that state the same information that you would get if you were to make a measurement on the quantum system. In fact, you can get more information because you actually have a description of the whole quantum state. Okay, so this doesn't change. So I can only say this. This doesn't change if we take quantum mechanics into account. So when I say this, I mean, for example, for uniform quantum circuits. So you can show that they have exactly the same power as, say, a Turing machine, in terms of what functions can be computed in prism. Okay, but now, so does that more or less answer your question? Yeah. So this is nice, because this says that, at least if we believe it, the things that we can, in principle, compute in the world, we don't have to worry about what particular model do we use. But on the other hand, we don't care, in practice, we don't care about what are the things that we can compute at all in any amount of time. We only care about the kinds of problems where we can get the answer to the computation out, somehow within our lifetime, right? I mean, if the computation is not going to finish before, the heat death of the universe or something like that, then we really don't care, right? So we really only care about computations that can be finished in a reasonable amount of time, and this is this notion of computational efficiency. So we want to have some sense in which we think about computations that can be done in a reasonable amount of time and computations that take an unreasonable amount of time. Okay. So what we're going to do to think about efficiency is we're going to think about computational problems that consist of inputs of many different sizes. So we're going to, you know, consider computational problems of arbitrary size. We'll consider many different inputs, and we could have an input of potentially arbitrary size. And what we're going to do is we're going to focus on the asymptotics of the running time of the best algorithm to solve that problem. So we say that an algorithm for such a problem is efficient if it runs in time which is polynomial in the input size. So time polynomial in n, where n is the number of bits describing the problem. Describing the problem instance. Okay, so what do I mean by poly of n? So what I just mean is that for large enough n, the running time should be upper bounded by some polynomial in the in n. So poly n means that, you know, there exists some n naught, which is, you know, we're only going to be interested in large enough n, so it's only going to be n's that are bigger than n naught, and there's going to be some constant c and some other constant d, such that for all n which are bigger than n naught, the function, so I guess I should say, you know, f of n is poly of n, means that, you know, so for all n which are bigger than n naught, f of n is at most c times n to the d. Okay, so it's growing like at most like some power of n up to constant factors, and you only care about the asymptotic behavior, so only the behavior for large enough n. Yes, question? So the problem would be, you know, so I mean, I'll state sort of notions of problems a bit more formally later on. But the problem could be, for example, you know, factoring integers, and the problem instance would be, you know, a particular integer that you might want to factor, right? So you want to factor the number, you know, 15. So you would be given some bit string that represents the number 15, and so n would be the number of bits that it takes to write down the problem, write down the number 15. Okay, so this is some kind of a definition that we can use. So we're going to say that you know, something is efficient if it runs in time polynomial in n, and here's the definition of what it means to be polynomial in n. This is a little bit arbitrary. Of course, it, you know, sweeps a lot of things under the rug. Like, for example, we could have some problem that we can solve in linear time. That would be polynomial time. We could have some other problem that where, you know, solving the problem would take time like, you know, a million times n to a million, right? And that would also be polynomial time because it's growing like some polynomial in n. But obviously, the second algorithm is a lot worse. So, you know, we're going to sweep these kinds of distinctions under the rug and only care about the difference between, you know, algorithms that run in some polynomial time and algorithms that run in more than polynomial time, like, say, exponential time. And, you know, this is a rather coarse distinction. But even understanding what goes on at this level, even understanding, you know, what you can do in polynomial time versus what you can't do in polynomial time is already beyond the reach of what we actually know how to show, what computer scientists actually know how to show, what they can prove things about. And we'll talk later in the lecture about kind of the depths of the ignorance that we have about computational complexity. It's really an area about which we know surprisingly little. Yes? Yeah, so if we had something that took only logarithmic time, that would be, you know, even better. Usually, you know, typically algorithms will take at least linear time because we have to read the whole input. But sometimes there are interesting things you can do in sublinear time, and I mean, it will depend on the fine details of the model. But the only distinction we're going to make here is, you know, at most polynomial time versus more than polynomial time. Yeah. Okay, good. Other questions? Okay. So then I wanted to kind of briefly mention, while I'm mentioning this notion of something growing polynomially, I wanted to mention just very briefly this idea of big O notation, which, do these things move? Okay. So this concept of big O notation, which maybe some of you have seen before, but I just want to mention because this will be useful when we want to represent things about the asymptotic complexity of algorithms. This will be a more fine-grained notion than just whether something takes polynomial time or exponential time. But it's, you know, so we won't be using it for the most part when we talk here about computational complexity, but it's related to this and it'll be quite useful later on. So probably some of you have seen some of these notions before. So for example, we say, and this was, I think, on the in the second tutorial, you used this notion of big O. So we would say that a function f of n is big O of g of n if f of n grows asymptotically like at most g of n. So if there exist constants n naught and c such that for all n bigger than n naught, f of n is at most c times g of n. So I know you've all seen this before because this was on the first tutorial. So this, you know, is a way of simplifying the what you say about the way f of n grows asymptotically so that you only care about the leading order behavior. So like, for example, if you have some expression like, you know, 10n squared plus 5n plus the log of n, and you sort of only care about the leading order behavior, you can just say that this is big O of n squared. And it simplifies things a lot. OK, but there are some related notations that maybe you see less often, but they're quite useful to have around. And so I just wanted to mention those very briefly. So we say that f of n is omega of g of n, so big omega of g of n, if you have a bound going the other way. So if there exist constants n naught and c such that for all n bigger than n naught, f of n is bigger than some constant times g of n. So this is an asymptotic lower bound, right? Whereas big O represents an asymptotic upper bound, big omega represents an asymptotic lower bound. And, you know, of course, you can also express it using big O notation. So another way of saying this is that g of n is big O of f of n. But sometimes if the thing you want to write simply is an asymptotic lower bound, then you actually want to use this big omega notation. So something we also sometimes write is that f of n is big theta of g of n. And we say this if f of n is both big O and big omega of g of n. And f of n is big omega of g of n. Or in other words, if f of n is big O of g of n, and g of n is also big O of f of n. Right? So this says that you have an asymptotic upper and lower bound, so you have a pretty tight characterization of how f grows. F grows basically the same way that g does asymptotically. And the last one, which is sometimes useful, is you say that f of n is little o of g of n. So this is sort of like the strict version of big O notation. So this says that the asymptotic growth of n is strictly less than that of g of n. So a way of saying this is just that the limit as n goes to infinity of the ratio f of n over g of n is 0. So for example, sometimes you write that something is little o of 1, just meaning that it's tending to 0 as n goes to infinity. Okay, so these are some quite useful notations if you want to analyze, if you want to express the running times of algorithms, or if you want to express limitations on the running times of algorithms by proving lower bounds. So are there questions about this? Maybe this isn't entirely new to all of you, but anyway, these are some notations that we'll probably be using in the rest of the lectures. Okay, so we have this notion of efficiency, and now what we would like to do. So we're going to, you know, for the rest of the lecture, we're mainly going to focus on this notion of polynomial time. So we'll just need this notation poly of n, and so. Now what we would like to do is we would like to think about the relationship between different computational models with respect to efficiency, right? So insofar as we believe the Church-Turing thesis, we think that the notion of whether you can compute something at all doesn't depend on the model that you take, but what about the notion of efficient computation? Okay, so maybe the best thing that we might hope for, well, it depends on your point of view, but you might think that the best thing you could hope for would be that there would be some strong version of the Church-Turing thesis, which said that all models were equivalent, not just with respect to the notion of what could be computed in principle, but also with respect to the notion of efficient computation. So maybe I should write, we could propose what we might call the strong Church-Turing thesis. Which would assert that the things that we can compute efficiently are exactly the things that can be computed efficiently by a Turing machine, regardless of what computational model we think about. So, so a function can be computed efficiently by any physically reasonable model of computation. So again, this will be a statement about physics. If and only if it can be computed efficiently by a Turing machine. Okay, but a Turing machine is a classical model of computation. So, you know, the notion of, so if this were the case, if it were the case that what can be computed efficiently can be computed efficiently by a Turing machine, then you know, this would be something that we would have to revisit in the light of quantum computing when quantum computers come along. And indeed, it seems that this strong Turing thesis is simply wrong because of the fact that we could have quantum computers. So quantum computers seem to invalidate this. Because, for example, there are problems like this problem of factoring integers that we can solve efficiently, so that we can solve in polynomial time using a quantum computer, but that we don't know how to solve efficiently using a classical computer, you know, using some program for a Turing machine or using classical circuits or any kind of way you might choose to represent classical computation. So this is really interesting, and this is kind of the whole reason, I mean, this is what really got people thinking seriously about the notion of quantum computing and even quantum information processing more broadly, this idea that there are things that you can do a lot better with a quantum computer, and this strong Church-Turing thesis simply doesn't seem to hold. Yes?
So with regards to like, the V equals NP problem, is that problem formulated in terms of physically reasonable models or classical computation?
Yeah, so we're going to talk about, I mean, this is coming up, but you know, so that's a problem about complexity classes, and I'm going to define complexity classes later on. And complexity classes are not, you know, they don't have anything to do with physics per se. They have something to do with a specific mathematical model of computation. So, you know, P, which I'll define later on, will be basically the things that you can compute in polynomial time by a classical computer. And, you know, that's some abstraction of some physical, you know, some means of computation that you could think about physically, but it's really a precise mathematical model. So, you know, the P versus NP problem is, you know, the question of whether P equals NP is just a mathematical question, and it's either true or false, independent of, you know, what we could say about the laws of physics. Of course, the question of whether we could, say, solve NP complete problems with some device we could build in practice, that's a different question. The answer is probably still no, we can't, but I mean, we'll talk about this later on. Okay, so now, but notice I say quantum computers seem to invalidate this. I don't say that quantum computers necessarily invalidate this, because while it's the case that, you know, we don't know a fast quantum algorithm, a fast classical algorithm for factoring, it could be that tomorrow one of you will discover one, or maybe one of you already has discovered one and you just haven't, you know, you just haven't published the paper yet. So, you know, it could always be that there's a fast classical algorithm for factoring. It's beyond our ability, our current ability, to prove that such things are not possible. So, you know, it could very well be that that there actually is some classical algorithm that makes Shor's algorithm obsolete because we can already factor on a classical computer. And in fact, it could even be the case that we could efficiently simulate quantum mechanics on classical computers. I mean, obviously, the naive strategy of just representing the whole quantum state you know, with some exponentially long vector and multiplying it by exponentially large matrices. Obviously, this doesn't work, but maybe there's a more clever strategy that will work. Of course, obviously not to describe an arbitrary quantum state, but to describe the quantum states that arise in efficient quantum computations that, you know, correspond to small quantum circuits. So we don't know. We can't say for sure that you can't simulate quantum mechanics efficiently with classical computers. We strongly suspect that it's not possible. But it always is a possibility that we have to have in the back of our minds. Okay. Other questions? Okay, so let's see if I can fix these boards. So I want, okay, I think that's what I want. Okay, so I guess the next thing that I want to do is introduce this notion of a complexity class, and this will allow us to talk more formally about, you know, the kinds of problems that, well, so first, what we mean by a computational problem, and what kinds of models of computation can solve those computational problems. So a complexity class is a way of formalizing the computational power of some particular model of computation. And so to do this, we first have to define the notion of a computational problem. And for convenience, and also, I guess, by convention, we usually focus on decision problems. So problems where we're given some input, and the output that we want to give is just yes or no. So we want to you know, compute some true or false property of the input that's given to us. And this is more or less without loss of generality, because if you want to produce a many-bit input, you can always represent that as, you know, computing individually each of the output that you want to compute. So this is more or less without loss of generality that we focus on decision problems. And the way that we'll talk about presenting a decision problem is in terms of what's called a language. So this is what's standard in computer science. So a problem is characterized by a language. And a language is simply a subset of all of the binary strings of any length. So there's some notation for this, which is 0, 1 star, which just means the set of all binary strings of any length. And then a computational problem will consist of being presented with some element of, well, of this set, so some string of some length. And then what you would like to do is tell whether that string is in the language or not. So we say that an algorithm recognizes or decides a language. If it will accept strings that are in the language and reject strings that are not in the language. So what an algorithm does is it runs some mechanical procedure for some amount of time, and at the end of the day, it either accepts or rejects. So it either says, you know, yes, this algorithm is in the language, yes, this string is in the language, or no, this string is not in the language, and it should be correct. So if it accepts x in, so let me call this language L, if it accepts x in L, and rejects x not in L. So just so you have some example in the back of your head, let me maybe give you some examples of some languages. So one language we might consider would be the language balanced, which consists of all the strings of any length that are balanced, meaning they have an equal number of zeros and ones. Obviously, this is a pretty simple language, but this is just a, you know, simple example to get started. So for example, the strings 0, 1, and 1, 0 would be in this language. And then, you know, 0, 0, 1, 1 would be in the language, and 0, 1, 0, 1 would be in the language. And there are many more strings, and you can't write them all down because there are infinitely many. But there's some kind of a concise description of what the language is. It consists of all of the strings that have an equal number of zeros and ones. Okay. Of course, for a language recognition problem, I mean, for a problem in the sense to be interesting, it had better, the language had better be an infinite set of strings, right? Because otherwise, an algorithm could just have a lookup table. And the running time would be constant because we only care about the asymptotic running time. OK, so another example that might be a little bit harder to come up with an algorithm for, but where actually you could still come up with an algorithm in polynomial time, although this was done actually only this century, is the language primes, which consists of all of the binary strings that represent prime numbers, right? So for example, 1, 0, right? That's the number 2 in binary, or 3, which would be 1, 1, or 5, which would be 1, 0, 1, et cetera. We could have all of the binary strings that that represent prime numbers. And we could ask, how hard is it to recognize whether a number is prime? So notice, this is not the factorization problem. This is just the problem of, you know, you're given a number and you want to tell whether it's prime or not. And actually, there is a classical algorithm which will deterministically figure out whether a number is prime, so whether a string that you're given belongs to this language. And as I said, this was discovered actually, you know, only like maybe 10 years ago. Okay, so these are languages that we could try to recognize, and there might be other languages that we wouldn't be able to recognize even in polynomial time. Although proving such a thing is often difficult. Okay, so this is the notion of a language. This is how we think about a computational problem. And then what is a complexity class? Well, a complexity class is simply a set of languages. So a complexity class is a set of languages. But typically, you know, for a complexity class to be interesting, it should represent the languages that can be recognized by some well-motivated mode of computation. So for example, thinking about whether an algorithm can, whether there exists an algorithm to recognize the language, set of languages. So maybe let me give you some examples of complexity classes. So here are maybe the three most basic complexity classes that we might think about from the standpoint of thinking about computations that can be done efficiently. So first of all, there's the complexity class P, and this consists of the languages that can be recognized by a classical algorithm running in polynomial time. And the algorithm really has to always work. So it has to be the case that if the string is in the language, it's definitely accepted by the algorithm, and if the string is not in the language, it's definitely rejected by the algorithm, and the algorithm has to finish in polynomial time. So P is the set of languages that can be decided by a classical algorithm in polynomial time. So polynomial time means, you know, the running time of the algorithm is some function of the size of the input. In other words, the number of bits in the string x that you're given. You want to decide whether x is in the language or not in the language. And the algorithm has to finish in some amount of time, which is polynomial in the length of x. And if x is in the language, it has to accept. If x is not in the language, it has to reject. OK, so this is P. This is this complexity class that you mentioned before. So another complexity class that's kind of important is what's called BPP. So this stands for bounded error probabilistic polynomial time. And here, the modification is that we allow ourselves to consider randomized algorithms. So still just classical algorithms. But that algorithm has access to a string of random bits, or it has the ability to flip coins and make choices on the basis of the results of those coin flips. OK, so this is languages that can be decided by a randomized algorithm, a classical randomized algorithm. In polynomial time, with at least some constant success probability bounded away from a half. So with success probability, let's say for concreteness, at least 2/3. And something that you can show is that because we're sweeping the details under the rug of exactly what polynomial running time we have, success probability 2/3 would give us exactly the same complexity class as success probability 9/10 or as success probability 0.51, or anything which is bounded away from a half by a constant amount. Yes? I wouldn't mind doing it, but maybe we should talk about it offline, because I think it would take a little while to do it. So I'm going to talk a bit later on about relationships between complexity classes, and although we don't know how to prove it, it's widely suspected that actually these two complexity classes are the same. So if you believe that, then you could try to make use of randomness, but it actually doesn't buy you anything. I could give you an example that I think would illustrate what's going on, but okay, well maybe we should just do it. Maybe we should just do it, let's just do it. So here's a kind of problem you could think about. So suppose we have some kind of a tree where we have AND or OR gates at the nodes, and the way that it'll work is, let's say we have AND gates at every other level, and we have OR gates at the, we have AND gates at the even levels and OR gates at the odd levels. Okay, and we're going to be thinking about a slightly different model of computation here, which is what's called query complexity, which I'm going to say something about later on, but where the measure of how hard it is to do something is the number of queries that you have to make to a bit string that lives at the leaves. So here we have some bits, x1, x2, up through x8. And there'll be some computational problem that consists of figuring out what the value is at the root of the tree, right? Here we should think about some value being stored, which is the logical OR of x1 and x2, and then there's some value here, which is the logical OR of x3 and x4, and this is the logical AND of the, these should have been ANDs. We want to alternate ANDs and ORs. This is the logical OR of the two values below it, et cetera. And then there's some value at the root of the tree. And so you could ask, with an algorithm that's given access to these values, that's given query access to these values, and say has to pay every time it wants to query one of the leaves, how much is it going to have to pay to learn the value at the root of the tree? So it's not too hard to see that if you require yourself to use a deterministic algorithm where you can't flip coins, you just have to know the whole string at the bottom. So you have to just query all of the input bits. There's just nothing else that you can do. I mean, maybe you have to think about that, but you can show that that's the case. But on the other hand, if you use a randomized strategy, you can do what's sometimes called alpha-beta pruning, where sometimes you can, what you can do is some kind of recursive algorithm where you randomly choose to evaluate either the left branch or the right branch. And if you happen to evaluate some whole subtree, and let's say here you get the value 0, then the AND has to be 0. You don't have to evaluate the other side, right? Because the only way that the AND can be 1 is if both of the inputs are 1. So suppose you do this kind of recursive algorithm where you randomly choose a child to evaluate, and then you evaluate it recursively. When you do that, sometimes you'll get lucky. And so you actually won't need to evaluate all of the leaves. And so you can show that whereas you would need omega n queries if you used a deterministic algorithm, it suffices to use O of n to the, I just happen to know this number. It's something like 0.753. There's some recursion you have to solve to get this out. So this is the running time of this strategy where you randomly choose one child or the other to evaluate, and you evaluate it recursively. And you sort of take into account how often it is that you get lucky. Well, right, that's one reason you might want to have randomness around, is because you could use it, for example, in computations. Yeah. Right, so this was what I was saying. So it doesn't matter what number you take there. So you could take 9/10, you could take 99%, you could take 0.51, and all of these numbers would be effectively the same, because if you have an algorithm for some, that works with some success probability, you can always boost the success probability by running the algorithm several times and taking, say, a majority vote of the outcomes that you get. And as long as you're bounded away from a half, then you know that you're going to be improving the success probability as you go. And you can sort of make these kinds of arguments precise using things like Chernoff bounds that sort of allow you to say how quickly the probability will go to one as you take the majority vote of many runs. When you say bounded away from a half, do you mean greater than one half? I mean that it should be bounded away from a half by a constant. So if it were, you know, so everything here is as a function of the input size. So if it was a half plus something exponentially small in the input size, that would not be good enough. But if it's a half plus any positive constant, that would be good enough. That's what I mean by bounded away from a half. Okay, good. Other questions? So this is just one example. I mean, certainly you could think of other examples where randomized computation at least seems to help. Like, for example, for this problem for deciding primality, there were algorithms that were known since the 70s that were randomized algorithms that you could show would run in polynomial time. And you know, it turns out that actually those algorithms can be de-randomized. So there is an algorithm that runs in polynomial time classically. But you know, doing that was quite hard. So another way that randomness can be helpful is just it gives you new tools for coming up with algorithms. Okay, so then the last of the complexity classes that I want to mention that characterize kind of notions of efficient computation with respect to some particular model of what sorts of computational resources you have at your disposal is BQP, which is the analog for quantum computation. So this would be languages that can be decided with a quantum computer in polynomial time, again with success probability at least 2/3. So this can be decided in poly time by a quantum computer with probability at least 2/3. Okay, so now we can draw some kind of a picture of the relationship between these complexity classes. It's kind of clear that you're only getting more power as you go down, right? So, in particular, if we have a BPP algorithm, we could just choose to never flip coins, and then we would have an algorithm that describes something in P. So we only get more power when we go to BPP. And similarly, if we have a quantum computer, you know, we can effectively flip coins because we could prepare plus states and measure them. So you know, that gives us at least as much power as BPP, but potentially more. So we can draw an inclusion diagram of these complexity classes, which looks as follows. So here we have P, and sitting outside it, we have BPP. And sitting outside that, we have BQP. And it's not known whether any of these inclusions is strict. So typically, when we pose some problem about complexity classes, you know, whether they might be the same or whether they might be different, it's generally not within our ability to answer those questions, so to prove whether two complexity classes are equal or not. I mean, sometimes this can be done, but often it cannot. But I can at least tell you what the conventional wisdom is. So the conventional wisdom is that probably P equals BPP. So in other words, you know, you can de-randomize randomized algorithms by using some kind of a pseudo-random number generator. It would be nice if you could show that you could do this, but we don't actually know how to show that this works, except maybe for specific problems. And on the other hand, we expect that BPP is different from BPP, from BQP. So in other words, we think that there are things that you can do with a quantum computer in polynomial time that you can't do with a classical, even with a randomized classical computer in polynomial time. Like, for example, maybe factoring would be a candidate for separating these two complexity classes. But we don't know how to prove that, because proving that it's hard to compute something is difficult, right? You have to think about the space of all possible algorithms, and you have to rule out the possibility that any conceivable algorithm could solve the problem fast. And that's quite a difficult thing to do. And it relates to the difficulty of this P versus NP problem, which I'm going to say something more about in a second. Okay, so I wanted to mention then a couple of other complexity classes that you might want to think about. So there are some complexity classes that don't necessarily characterize what we might think of as efficient computation with respect to the amount of time that it takes, but just quantify some other resource. Okay, but first, you have a question? That's right. I mean, this is the fact that the conventional wisdom is that these two things are not equal. This is the same as the statement I made before, that it seems like the strong Church-Turing thesis is not true. Yeah. I mean, I guess that would be that, you know, we think that P is not equal to BQP, because the power of Turing machines is the power of P, and you know, the power of quantum computers is the power of BQP. So this is the this is the same thing as saying that the strong Church-Turing thesis doesn't hold. I mean, these two things are equivalent. We don't know how to prove either of them. Yeah. Okay, so there are a couple more complexity classes that I could mention. So two more complexity classes. So the first one is called p-space. And the idea here is that we only care not about the running time of the algorithm, but about the amount of space that it uses. So this would be the set of languages that can be decided in polynomial space. So now deterministically, I mean, actually, if we allowed randomness here, it wouldn't make a difference. So languages that can be decided in polynomial space, so an amount of space which is polynomial in the input size, but no bound on the running time. So you can only ever write to a polynomial number of scratch bits that you have lying around, but you know you could take as much time as you want. And then an even bigger class would be what's called exp. So this would be the set of languages that can be decided in exponential time. Okay, now it's not too hard to see that actually, so you never need more than exponential time with a p-space algorithm. Because if you only have a polynomial amount of space, you could run through all the possible configurations of the memory in exponential time. So so p-space is actually, you know, a subset of x, probably a proper subset, but we don't know how to show that. And so we could make a picture now, you know, we could enlarge this picture to also include these two complexity classes. And it turns out that the picture would look like the following. So everything, so they just kind of nest within each other. So here's P, here's BPP, here's BQP. Now BQP is certainly within exp, right? That's something that we observed earlier on, that you could just multiply these exponentially large matrices. So somehow out here is exp. And I argued that P space sits inside exp. Well, actually, you can show that BQP sits inside P space. So the picture looks like this. So in fact, not only can you simulate quantum computation using an exponential amount of time, but you can do it using only a polynomial amount of space. And this is maybe not so obvious, right? Because the naive exponential time algorithm that I sketched before would certainly also use an exponential amount of space, because it wrote down the whole state vector. So so you can show, it turns out, that BQP is contained in P space. So in other words, anything you can do with a quantum computer, you can do with a classical computer using only polynomial space. So let's leave this as an exercise. It's a nice thing to think about. So you know there's a vast set of different kinds of computational power in this picture, right? Here we have polynomial time, here we have exponential time, and you know surely you must be able to compute more and more as you go to the bigger and bigger pieces of this picture, right? So surely we should be able to prove that what you can do with some of the kinds of computation that are described here are different. And actually, there's only one thing that we know how to prove. I mean, we can prove containments like this, but to actually prove that two classes are different, there's only one thing that we know how to prove about this picture. So it can be shown that P is not equal to exp. So this class and this class are not the same. There's something you can do in exponential time that you can't do in polynomial time. Right? So, so this is something that can be proven. So what that says is that somewhere in this picture, there must be two complexity classes that are equal, right? Either exp is not equal to p-space, or p-space is not equal to BQP, or BQP is not equal to BPP. Well, I mean, we actually suspect that that's true, but we don't know how to prove it. Or BPP is not equal to P. Right? So somewhere along the way, two classes have to be not the same thing. but we don't know which two. I mean, we can't prove which two. It's this is, you know, I'm trying to sort of convey, as I was saying, the depths of our ignorance about complexity theory. So it's, you know, it's very hard to separate complexity classes because you have to show that there's some problem you can't solve with some particular way of quantifying resources, and this means somehow running over all possible algorithms. That's this picture, and it sort of encapsulates what we do know, and also some of our aspirations for maybe what we'd like to prove about the power of different kinds of computation. Okay, so I guess I should stop there. So I also wanted to talk about this complexity class NP, which is important. So maybe I'll say something about that next time, and also about this notion of black box computation. So that's the model that refers to this problem that I was talking about briefly here, and that we're going to be using when we start to talk about introductory quantum algorithms. But so maybe I'll save that for next time, and then we'll use that model to see an example of a problem that we can solve faster with a quantum computer than with a classical one. Okay. Any last questions? Yes. How is the probability introduced? So it's a randomized algorithm. So what that means is an algorithm that's allowed to flip coins in the course of its execution. Or you could imagine that it has access to some string of random bits and it's allowed to look them up as it goes. I mean, those would be the same thing. So the fact that it's randomized would just come from some additional power that you give it, that, you know, it's allowed to flip a coin and it says, okay, heads, I'm going to, you know, do this gate, tails, I'm going to do this gate. I mean, we would have the ability to flip a coin because we could say prepare a state, you know, 1 over root 2, 0 plus 1, and then measure it in the computational basis. And that's the same thing as flipping a coin because we get, you know, 0 with probability a half and 1 with probability a half. So that's one thing we could do. But of course, there are many more general things we can do with a quantum algorithm. We can do things in superposition. And we have the possibility for interference between different computational paths, where we have positive and negative amplitudes, or, you know, complex amplitudes with different phases that interfere with each other. And so, you know, the set of what we can do with quantum computers is, I mean, it's much richer. And that's why we suspect that there might be more computational power here than here. Other questions? Okay, so see you on Monday, I guess.